My lifelong obsession with books began not because I grew up in a family of book lovers, or because I had access to an intellectually stimulating private library, or that my father was an English professor, or that my mother was a poet. No, it had to do with deprivation. My mother was in fact a housewife who doubled as an organist every Sunday at the First Methodist Church in Littleton, Colorado. She was a gifted storyteller, but I don't remember ever seeing her sit down to read a book. My father, bless him, was neither a musician nor a rock auteur, and he definitely wasn't a reader of books. His line was aerospace engineering. My parents kept an immaculate house, and our living room was the most dusted, vacuumed, polished, burnished, formerly furnished room in our otherwise typical middle-class single-story brick house. The carpet was off-white. The shades were drawn during the day to keep the furniture from fading. A porcelain figurine of a ballerina sat on the coffee table, frozen in a pirouette and looking a little forlorn, I always thought. Meticulously arranged on the mantel, over a fireplace in which no fire was ever lit, was a set of Charles Dickens in very handsome olive green gold stamped cloth from the late 19th century. The set was incomplete with a number of volumes missing, but it was in pristine condition and, truth to tell, it made for an awfully nice piece of furniture. My mom, who had moved with my father to the western slope of Colorado where they lived until their recent deaths, and who displayed that same Dickens set in a prominent place in their new house where off-white wall-to-wall carpeting still obtained, would probably not have wanted me to reveal this. But one day when I was about 7 or so, I was caught sitting on the sofa in my dirty jeans and t-shirt reading Bleak House. I don't remember what my punishment was, but I never touched those books again. In retaliation, but also to be fair to her, with my mom's help, I got a library card and started checking out stacks of books on every subject. Though I would later become a novelist, classic literary novels were my earliest passion. Neophyte science books, travel chronicles, basic history books, adventure stories, including Tolkien's The Hobbit, and of course that gateway to endlessly inventive narratives, The Arabian Nights. These were my vade mecums. My self-invented adolescent curriculum was scattershot at best. But it gave me solace to know that while Dickens might sit on the mantel down the hall from my bedroom, a prisoner to my mother's innocent, obsessive-compulsive disorder, I could pile up volumes of books on my little oak desk and read them whenever I'd finished my chores and homework. My first encounter with a private library, lowercase l, was in Cuneo, Italy, where I finished my last year of high school as a foreign exchange student. There were no first editions in the modest study of the Del Piano family with whom I lived, but Minu Del Piano, my adored host mother, and the English teacher at the Liceo Scientifico, where I attended classes, had assembled an impressive collection of mostly Penguin paperbacks of the classics of English and world literature. Those many orange spines, that wall of Penguin orange, represented to me everything that was serious and valuable, from George Eliot to Charlotte Bronte, Jane Austen to Gustave Flaubert, Oscar Wilde to Virginia Woolf. For me, a Penguin paperback was the aesthetic crown jewel of books. Light of weight in the hand, the text legible, the covers either admirably plain or with some ravishing period painting that I could stare at when pondering the meaning of some passage that puzzled or moved me. Above all, the texts, the glorious texts preserved within, engendered a kind of secular spirituality such that even when I happened not to like a particular Penguin published novel or story collection, I respectfully reshelved the volume knowing I might want to revisit it later in life. When I started to read in Italian, I noticed there were two distinct aesthetics to Italian bookmaking. Hardcovers had thin flexible bindings covered in fine cloth that felt good, almost erotic to the touch. Paperbacks of Leonardo Sciascia or Cesare Pavese that I bought in train stations, on the other hand, were often bound with cheap glue the color of tobacco spit, the consistency of dried snot, and the adherence of, well, of nothing. When you turn the page obligingly detached from the spine. A rather interesting way to read a book, because obviously when you were finished, all you had left intact was the cover. However, Mino Del Piano's Penguins, which I devoured, title after title, faring better than their Italian cousins. I handled them with fond care, and they provided me with the foundation of my knowledge of literature. It was when I was doing my undergraduate work at the University of Colorado in Boulder that I had my first encounter with a rare book. One of my professors, Dr. Donald Baker, was a highly sophisticated collector of early works of philosophy and literature, from Incunabula, which is pre-1500, up through the 18th century. Baker was a brilliant eccentric who spoke fluent Chinese, had a long mane of hair as black as India ink, wore a mortuary attendant-like white shirt and black suit every day, and had no patience with my unbridled enthusiasm for Ezra Pound at that time. Forget Saul Bellow or Thomas Pynchon. His idea of a modern first edition would have been a set of Tom Jones or Tobias Smollett's Peregrine Pickle in contemporary cap. One day he brought to class a late 15th or early 16th century copy of Boethius' Consolation of Philosophy. And after showing us how properly to hold the book so as not to damage the binding, he allowed us to pass it around. I remember being electrified by the experience. If, as Pound said, a book should be a ball of light in one's hands, this Boethius, bound in a drab brown blindstaff calf, was a megawatt luminosity. It's hard to explain to someone who doesn't have what I think of as a bibliophilic neural center hardwired into the brain that sets off cortical fireworks when one comes into contact with an especially wondrous book, but I definitely discovered my inner bibliomaniac that day. When I asked Professor Baker after class if he had other books like that, he said something to the effect that you can't just own one such book, and that collecting is a benign malady, and invited me up to his office. On the top floor of the English department building, a warren of cubbies with creaking wooden floors, was what amounted to a casual cathedral of rare books. John Donne, Ben Jonson, Milton, Spencer, Herrick, Herbert, Mallory, Marble, Johnson's Shakespeare, all the pinnacles and many of the foothills of English lit were here. And on his cluttered desk was an unopened parcel from Blackwell's of Oxford. I was dazzled, even though I didn't know the half of what I was witnessing. In the hour or so he afforded me, generously telling me about the difference between speckled calf and goat and vellum, the importance of margins, the gaudy glory of Riviera's Morocco bindings with Hollinger's gilt, Sikorsky and Sutcliffe, which was an octavo, a quarto, a folio, I was baptized and initiated into the brotherhood of bibliophiles. He even opened up that parcel so I could see his latest acquisition. I remember with perfect clarity, it was a three-volume set of Henry Fielding's Miscellanies. At the time, I was a junior living off campus, and the walk to downtown Boulder was easy. Baker had mentioned a bookshop called Stage House 2, run by a man named Richard Schwartz. Making money on the side as a jazz musician in the Steve Getz Quintet, Stan's son, another story for another day, I started spending it on a hodgepodge of books at Stage House and paying my bills, which quite quickly piled up in installments. I bought some Pound and Thomas Mann, an early edition of Dante's La Vita Nuova, a copy of the second edition of Johnson's Dictionary, whose boards, though original, were detached. Two things happened after I toted home the two massive dictionary volumes. You ever seen a Johnson's Dictionary, by the way? It's like, you know what I'm talking, Samuel Johnson wrote like the great first dictionary names. It's like this big, that tall. And there are two volumes of each that thick, and he wrote it himself. He did the entire lexicography of his own. Amazing. Two things happened after I toted home the two massive dictionary volumes, one under each arm. First, I decided that I needed to become a bookbinder in order to repair the Johnson. It made perfect sense to me at the time, though of course in retrospect, I could have simply given it to the man who had become my binding teacher and had him do it. But I wanted to know exactly how a book was engineered, if you will. Wanted to understand why some spines were rounded or flat and others had raised bands. How a book in pieces could be seamlessly mended back together, resewn, rebacked, salvaged for future generations. So I interned at a small private bindery and wound up learning the basics of binding and restoration. I still have some of my equipment, a nipping press, a sewing frame, and a tub of lanolin anhydrous for treating leather that some archaeologist might find of interest one day. I should add that I did read back that copy of Johnson's Dictionary, dyeing the leather to match the boards, using my bone folder, a bookbinding tool dating to the medieval period, to form the end caps of each volume just right, laying down the paper-thin original leather labels. And I'm proud to say that it's now housed at Cornell Library, where it's part of their estimable Samuel Johnson Research Collection. The other thing that happened was that the next time I set foot in Dick Schwartz's bookshop, he genially asked me, "Do you know how much money you owe me?" I did, I said. "Good," said he with a broad smile. We'd kind of become friends by then, and he and his wife had me over to their home for meals many a night. Schwartz then handed me a broom and dispatched me to the second floor, where he had a prints and maps gallery, as well as thousands and thousands more books. "You now have a job." I was elated. No happier man ever swept a floor. Whenever I wasn't in classes or at the library studying or playing a gig in some nightclub on Colfax Avenue in Denver, I was in Stagehouse 2, shelving books, packing books, and yes, cubbying myself on off hours in cul-de-sacs in the teeming stacks, reading books. Schwartz had some pretty wealthy clients among the general used bookstore crowd. Crosby, Stills, and Nash were in and out of the shop, and Graham Nash in particular had superb taste in vintage photographs and fine bindings, as I remember. The point being, I got to watch a lot of very interesting materials flow in and out of the inventory. I was getting a second education, thanks to Dick, and long after I left Boulder to attend grad school at Yale, he and I remained close as friends. He died some years ago, and it remains a great personal loss to me. I've known so many great bookmen in my life, but he was, for me, essential and special. One of the speakers who visited campus during my last year in Boulder was Ezra Pound's daughter, Mary DeRockowitz. By my early 20s, I had become a serious student of the Cantos and had published exegetic essays on Cantos 4 and 36 in Paidoima, the Journal of Pound Studies. I had recently learned that I'd won a Danforth Fellowship, which provided me with tuition and living expenses to do grad work in comp lit at the university of my choice, and I was debating where to go. Over tea with Mary, I learned that the Beinecke Library at Yale had just acquired the Pound Archives, and she suggested that might be the right place. I exchanged a couple of letters with the Pound scholar Hugh Kenner, who'd admired my precocious and recherche pieces on the Cantos, and it was settled. I rented a U-Haul van, loaded up my books, my several articles of clothing, more books, some paintings I'd made during my brief flirtation with becoming a painter, more books, my guitar, yet more books, and moved to New Haven. As it happened, here comes the confession. The Danforth Foundation gave me my stipend to cover living expenses for my first year in one lump sum. We see where this is going. A more mature Danforth fellow would have spent this on strong coffee, square meals, and maybe a Yale sweatshirt, and set the rest aside. But I was not mature. By this time, age 22, I was thoroughly book diseased. That broken set of Dickens maybe troubled my subconscious mind. But for some reason ineffable to me then, and even now, I was deeply compelled, paraphrasing T.S. Eliot, to shore these books against my ruin. A bookshop right across from campus. Not a bar, a bookshop, you know. This is what I was drawn to. C.A. Stonehill, whose proprietors were highly sophisticated dealers in 18th century books, proved to be my Rubicon. Part of addiction is denial. The way I charted a course around direct confrontation with the Pennywise angel on one shoulder while succumbing to the Poundwise demon on my other, not pound foolish because I lost money on very few of my acquisitions, was this. When I was assigned to read Tristram Shandy, well, then I figured I might as well read it in a first edition. The experience would be closer to what Stern's readership experienced and therefore more real, I assured myself, with not a hint of irony. So after a preliminary reading of the novel in a fat, drab, gray paperback, which I still own, I bought a set of the 9 volumes, 1760 to 67, the first two in second impressions, all in original calf bindings with paneled boards characteristic for the period, and with Stern's handwritten signature in volumes 5, 7, and 9, which he did in all first edition volumes to secure copyright. I don't remember what Stonehill charged me, which is unusual because I could hardly remember what I had for dinner the day before yesterday, but I can tell you with absolute certainty what I paid them for my copy of Sir Thomas Browne's Pseudodoxia Epidemica, which I had not been assigned to read. And there's the rub. I binged on rare books. I took the train to New York and visited the legendary bookseller Margie Cohen at House of Books on Madison Avenue and purchased an unfaded inscribed copy in dust jacket of Cyril Connolly's Enemies of Promise, while contemplating but deciding against using any more of my Danforth funding to buy a 1922 Ulysses. Knowing Margie, who over the course of 60 years in business had been close friends with everyone from Ernest Hemingway to Tom Stoppard, she probably wanted a song for it. But my mistake in not taking it back to New Haven is so much Aegean blue water under the bridge. Aegean blue being the specific color that Joyce insisted the printers use on the covers of Ulysses. After my amicable comeuppance with my friend Dick back in Boulder, I always paid my bills up front. Running out of money, I had no more patience for brooms. I was busy deconstructing 19th century novels such as Thackeray's Henry Esmond under the tutelage of the formidable J. Hillis Miller, sitting in on classes with fellow Yale deconstructionists Harold Bloom and Jeffrey Hartman, as well as working with kinder, gentler, classically trained men of letters such as the great Shakespearean scholar Eugene Waith, who edited Macbeth for the Yale Shakespeare. So I did what anyone in my overextended position would logically do. I got a job in a local Italian mafia restaurant. I had neither experience nor competence as a waiter. I was too tall, too awkward, too distracted, too intractable, but I could speak fluent Italian. My employment didn't last long, several months, but at least I quit the day before I was going to be fired. I walked back to my apartment on Orange Street, smelling as ever of fried calamari, clams casino, and puttanesca sauce, but all squared away with my John Dryden and Alexander Pope debts. I fell in love with a girl upstairs. I got married. My thesis interest had switched from Ezra Pound to the underappreciated Vortices novelist Wyndham Lewis, author of Tar, The Apes of God, and The Revenge for Love. And seeing that there was little scholarship on him, Pound was by that time a grad school thesis mill, and though I might submit to being a waiter at a mafia restaurant, I never wanted to be a mill worker. I took a leave of absence and with my wife moved to Ithaca, New York, where most of the Lewis papers were housed at Cornell. Lewis needed an annotated biobibliography if there ever was going to be any serious scholarship about his work, I decided. So that's what I was going to do. By the way, Kathleen worked in the darkroom of a photography shop, stripping and developing film. So on our wedding license, where we were required to list our jobs, I wrote unemployed and she wrote stripper. Anyway, I had never written even a checklist before, let alone a full-scale bibliography, but I figured this was a matter of learning the rules, working with dogged persistence, and making it happen. I had the good fortune of finding a collaborator in another Lewis aficionado, Bernard Lafourcade, a French scholar who happened to be living in Carthage, Tunisia. We joked about our Ithaca-Carthage connection. And I immersed myself in Friesenbauer's then archetypal Principles of Bibliographic Description and studied Donald Gallup's seminal bibliographies of Pound and Eliot. The venerable Gallup and I met at Yale Hospital the year before in back-vented gowns as we awaited nasty, invasive procedures for similar abdominal complaints. Such an elegant gentleman, I thought at the time, as we carped about how cold the bench was on our bare bottoms and talked about Ezra Pound. This is at a level of highly specialized outre-ness that I hesitate to share, but there it is. I have thousands of books inscribed to me by authors who are far closer friends than Gallup ever was, but I do cherish my copy of his Pound bibliography, which is inscribed for Bradford Morrow, fellow worker in the vineyard. This Lewis thesis metamorphosed into a large and complex book. A book I wrote without a contract or a publisher. I was working at the time as a freelance book scout for the best local bookshop in Ithaca, the Bookery, to help make ends meet when Hugh Kenner put me in touch with the publisher of Black Sparrow Press, John Martin, in Santa Barbara, California. This is where Robert comes in. A curious mix of Christian Scientist teetotaler values, as well as renegade drunken Charles Bukowski's longtime publisher, John offered to publish my bibliography essentially sight unseen. He and I became fast friends on the phone, and one day he asked where my wife and I were going to move once the book was done. I had no idea. He said, "Move out here." I said, "All right." When I informed Yale and the kind folks at Danforth that I wanted to extend my leave and move to California. Now, a man named Maurice F. Neville is largely forgotten as a bookseller, I think. But at the time, he was a Montecito millionaire who had a hankering to get into the very book business, and because of his money and taste for high spots, which are pretty obvious. I guess a high spot is pretty obvious, like, you know, really well-known books that are worth a lot of money. Sort of boring, frankly. He had an elevated profile at the time. He bought a landmark adobe in Santa Barbara, had handsome shelves built, and from Heritage Books in Los Angeles purchased what in retrospect was one of the greatest collections of 20th century first editions ever to come on the market. Whatever he paid for the Norman Unger collection, Neville made a brilliant purchase. John Martin told him he should hire me to help catalog and price the trove. Once again, I found myself in the position of having to learn on the spot and not make mistakes. This was how I became, briefly, what would be known in the book trade as one of the Santa Barbarians, a group of very competitive dealers concentrated in a very small town. And this is about the time I met you, right, Robert? You knew John Martin. You were being published by Black Sparrow.
Yeah. 81?
Yeah, right in there. I think it was like 79. Norman Unger's approach to collecting was weird, yet flat-footedly commonsensical from a preservationist point of view. Back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and even into the 60s, he habitually read the reviews of all the new works of literary fiction and poetry coming out, and if he himself then read and liked a book, he would purchase multiple copies, wrap the first editions in tissue, and store them away in boxes. As a result, books that are notoriously vulnerable to wear, such as Norman Mailer's first novel, The Naked and the Dead, with its cheap black binding and black jacket that seems to chip at a blink, emerged from these boxes many years later, absolutely as fresh as the day they were published. It was a time machine of a collection. And while I knew I was dealing with something stunningly unusual, after days and weeks of pulling out stacks of first editions like The Grapes of Wrath, like this many Grapes of Wrath, and East of Eden in shockingly new shape, I didn't become inured, but something else changed in me. I began to realize this is what true collector's copies look like. That is, unless there's a significant inscription involved. An association copy of an important book I once held in my hands at a Boston book fair, the copy of Walden, inscribed by Thoreau to Emerson, is another thing. But as uninscribed regular modern first go, the colors of the dust jacket needed to be fresh and vibrant, the top edge stain unfaded, the text block square, the boards unrun, the book essentially as new as when the author held it in his or her hand on publication day. Against all odds, we got most of the collection priced and shelved, and there was a catered bookstore opening memorialized by a signed limited Charles Bukowski pamphlet, and some of the best dealers on the West Coast were there. But the man I met that day who would change my life again, see how bibliophilia works, was the B poet Kenneth Rexroth. I have no idea who invited him, but he was the biggest local literary celebrity besides the mystery writer Ross MacDonald. And he and I struck up a conversation that continued for days, into weeks, months, and years. So now imagine three narratives evolving, crisscrossing, threading themselves like a literary braid. The first strand was that after 6 months of working for Neville, I realized that he and I were not meant to go on together. So I quit with barely $1,000 to my name, if that, and decided I would start my own business. With John Martin's help, I tracked down a fine collection of modern firsts in Los Angeles, having borrowed money from a family member who shall remain anonymous because of the mortifyingly exorbitant interest rate he charged me. I calculated at just a little over 200%. I should have just gone back to the mafia guys. The collector had been relentless about getting his book signed, so I found myself swimming in autographed Tennessee Williamses, Eudora Welties, Edward Albee's, and others. I fairly quickly earned back the borrowed money, paid off my loan, and hit the pre-internet road to begin scouting new stock in San Francisco and Berkeley. Peter Howard, did you ever know him, Peter Howard? Yeah, Peter Howard, the legendary Serendipity Books, one of the great booksellers ever, and a huge champion of new poetry when it was new over the course of half a century, was kind enough to lock me inside his shop overnight, where I read and slept on a cot when I was too exhausted to keep exploring his endless inventory. By the time my first catalog came out in June 1978, I had spent all the money I had to my name on more books, great and incomparable books, I felt, but indeed had to mail out the catalog incrementally because in my blind enthusiasm, I failed to set aside enough cash for postage. Any bookseller who's been around for a while looks back at his or her first catalog and wishes for all the world it were possible to get some of the books back. For instance, I wouldn't mind repatriating the lovely dust jacket and copy of To Kill a Mockingbird that I listed at $75, a book now worth well beyond my rational means, or my 1897 Captain's Courageous in Dust Jacket, or the only surviving manuscript of F. Scott Fitzgerald's first Basil and Josephine story, which consisted of 19 carbon typescript pages with corrections in Fitzgerald's hand, and some of which were significant, adding whole phrases at times. A far less valuable, but to me equally interesting listing in the catalog was that I also offered my Wyndham Lewis book, which was to be published by that August by Black Sparrow. What this meant was that my work after leaving Yale was meshing with my work as a fledgling bookseller, which at the age of 27 gave me a sense of balance. My scholarly impulses were counterweighted by the impetus to develop a viable rare book business. At the same time, though I didn't mention it to many, if any, I began writing poems and stories just as I had, rather shyly and secretly, when I was in Italy in my teens and at college. Art was rearing its head concurrently with these other activities. I attribute this in part to Rex Roth. I'd begun to spend a lot of time with him in his funky converted barn library, where some 16,000 volumes were housed, most of them having in fact been read by this great poet, translator, essayist, and polymath. Kenneth was living, breathing, talking literary history, and though we were 50 years apart in age, the camaraderie we developed collapsed time in such a way that a very familial friendship was born. I knew that he'd introduced Allen Ginsberg at the famous Gallery 6 reading of Howl. I knew that he was considered by many to be father of the Beats. Though what I didn't realize was that Kenneth had always wanted to be a bookseller. He even dabbled in bookselling when he was still living in San Francisco, and showed me the stationery for Kenneth Rexroth books, elegant black type on white bond. He enjoyed the proximity to my inchoate enterprise, working out of my round rented house that resembled a spaceship in the mountains above Montecito, and gave me all kinds of advice about how to live my life to the max, and got me to read everything from Restif de Le Breton to Milarepa, from Tale of Genji to The Golden Ass. A new phase in my engagement with books was about to begin. I had studied books, bound and restored books, published scholarly articles and books. Somewhere around this time, I also wrote a full-scale bibliography of Black Sparrow Press with Seamus Cooney and with an introduction by Robert Kelly. Worked at both used and rare book businesses, started my own bookshop with money I might better have borrowed from my mafia restaurant acquaintances, but as yet I hadn't tried my hand at publishing books. My rare book enterprise was grossing more than I'd ever expected by then. I sold the original holograph manuscript of Steinbeck's classic, The Pearl, to Salinas Public Library and found myself in the national news when I turned 28. And so I wanted to try something new, forge my next engagement with the book. To Rex Roth's amused disgust, I had acquired a large collection of William Burroughs books and manuscripts. Kenneth taunted, "Shame on you for having anything to do with that murderer." For those of you who don't know this unsavory bit of literary history, Burroughs accidentally killed his wife, Joan Vollmer, in Mexico City in 1951 while they were trying to play William Tell, drunken attempt to play William Tell. In the collection, unbeknownst to me for its eventual textual importance when I bought it, was an original hand-corrected typescript of what proved to be a variant passage from The Naked Lunch called Dr. Benway. Once I realized what I had in my possession, having read the manuscript word for word against both the Olympia and Grove Press editions, I sent a letter to Burroughs and his amanuensis James Grabberholz, telling them about the discovery and offering to publish it in a paperback as well as a signed limited edition for copyright purposes. This was a long shot, obviously, but I saw no harm in trying to put this significant, apparently suppressed document into print. And had Burroughs rejected the idea, I would happily provide him with a copy of the manuscript for his record and moved on. Instead, I got an enthusiastic letter from Burroughs saying that he would love to see it published. He even provided an introduction. The book, whose title page I designed after a kind of 17th century model, with a classic look intended to belie the raucous and kinky violence in the text, and whose cover my wife illustrated after a painting by Klimt, came out on the 20th anniversary of the original appearance of the novel. So there was a celebratory element in all this. I will never forget my mother's response after I sent her a copy. "My son, the pornographer," she said. That worked for me. Meanwhile, though, William and Grauerholz and I became friends. And when a year and a half later I would leave picturesque of somewhat fractious Santa Barbara and move to New York, my brownstone apartment on 9th Street in the West Village would become a meeting place for Burroughs soirees. When William was around drinking his vodka and Cokes and smoking endless cigarettes, I never knew who I would be buzzing up to join us. Ginsberg and other writers, of course, but also Blondie, Iggy Pop, Keith Haring, etc. Soft-spoken as he was and generally demure, William attracted rockers, painters, the famous. Sometime after I brought out Dr. Benway, before I left Santa Barbara, Rex Roth, who did forgive me my sin of associating myself with a junkie killer, and I were in his library discussing the idea of doing a project of our own together. It amazes me how many projects over the years have come into being simply because a friend of mine and I wanted to roll up our sleeves and make a book. David Shields and I did our anthology on death, The Inevitable, which came out with Norton the year before last, in just this way. The British novelist Patrick McGraw and I put together an anthology in the 90s called The New Gothic, in much the same manner. And so it was back in Santa Barbara when Kenneth and I decided we wanted to edit a series together. The idea we had was to assemble a festschrift for James Lachlan, the longtime publisher of New Directions, as the first issue of a literary journal. Lachlan had published all of Kenneth's major works, and as for myself, New Directions had given me my education, as Penguin had done before, not only in Ezra Pound, but William Carlos Williams, Dylan Thomas, Kenneth Patchen, Garcia Lorca, not to mention Rex Roth himself, as well as a host of other writers whose work I read solely based on the fact that they were New Directions authors. When Kenneth telephoned Lachlan to see if he had any problem with our proposal, Lachlan reportedly, quote, "giggled like a bride being carried upstairs to the bedroom." I got to know Lachlan quite well in later years, and much as I adore Kenneth's image, I honestly cannot imagine the strapping, sedate, aristocratic liege of modernist avant-garde publishing giggling. Either way, Rex Roth and I compiled a list of some 80 potential contributors. He had letterhead printed up, having named this neophyte journal Conjunctions, and mailed the invitations out. I should add here that in the meantime, I published a limited edition of Rex Roth's autobiographical excerpts from a life under the imprint of Conjunctions book. But with all my other commitments, it would prove to be the first and last such Conjunctions book. On the other hand, the literary journal Conjunctions was about to take off in ways I could never have imagined. I was stunned to receive replies from nearly all the authors I had asked to contribute to our celebration of the visionary behind New Directions. It was heady, to say the least, to hear back from Paul Bowles and Tennessee Williams, Gary Snyder and John Hawks, Denise Levertov and James Purdy, Susan Sontag and Samuel Beckett. I didn't even have Beckett's address. I just wrote him Samuel Beckett, Paris, France. And it got to him. Amazing. That was the day. When the post office worked. Something profound was happening to me psychically and intellectually as a result of this project. What I mean to say is that my scholarly work and my efforts as an antiquarian bookseller, specializing mostly in 20th century literature, constituted frames through which I viewed the activity of making novels, poetry, plays, short story collections as somehow unembodied. I met some famous writers and felt curiously at ease with them. Sitting across from Henry Miller in his bathrobe poolside at his house in Santa Monica didn't faze me that much. I marveled more at the fact that he still had a strong Brooklyn accent and the robust energy of a far younger man than he was, robust energy of a far younger man than that he was talking to me about Paul Bowles, ping pong, and the Cold War. I admired and liked Burroughs and Rexroth, also renowned, but knowing them didn't leave me feeling stardusted, as it were. By now corresponding all of a sudden with what grew to be over 100 writers, with each with very different, most of them uniquely brilliant, and learning in the cauldron of the moment how to edit their manuscripts, prepare copy edited typescripts for the typesetter, correct proofs, all boilerplate principia, brought to life the rigors, the flesh and blood dynamics of the literary life vital and lived. Books themselves were not so much artifacts as they were beings that had been born of visceral imagination and had souls, fates, friends, aspirations. Paper was flesh, from flesh. Ideas were blood, from blood. I realized that when you opened a book, it became awake. When you closed it, it went to sleep. You ignored it, it died. I don't know whether I'm explaining this clearly, but it was an epiphany that changed my life. A book in my hand, its words in my eyes, meant I was alive, gave me voices to listen to, argue with, dissect. It was, to paraphrase Stendhal, a mirror carried down my road, reflecting all that was ahead, behind, and in that moment. In the most basic ways, books had given me my reason to be, my life. When dear Kenneth had a series of debilitating strokes that left him speechless before the Festschrift was even partially done, it fell to me to finish the volume on my own. Although I went to the hospital where Rexroth's wife told the staff that I was his grandson in order to get me into the ICU, to comfort him and tell him about progress. It was a stressful time with low lows and hopeful highs, but most of all it was fraught with deep doubts about whether I hadn't gotten myself into something that was way over my head. I was literally writing in the morning, working all day at the bookshop, and working much of the night on the conjunctions. At 320 pages, published both in paperback and hardcover, Conjunctions 1, A Festschrift in Honor of James Lachlan, was a hefty inaugural issue, funded not by government grants or philanthropists, but by myself. Those first issues were once more quixotic, idealistic black holes for hard-earned money. I didn't care. I felt invigorated. Much as I loved bookselling, I wanted to set it aside and pursue living literature. Working on that issue directed me into the next chapters of my book life. I had been pondering a move to New York City. Rightly or wrongly, it seemed to me that New York was where many of the writers I most admired lived. Kenneth despised the East Coast, and especially New York. Never at a loss for leveling strong opinions, he also thought most novels were lowbrow art for lowbrows. When I told him I wanted to continue editing Conjunctions in New York, including edit postmodernist work he didn't much care for, and that I also wanted to write novels, he saw I wasn't going to be reasoned out of my dream, and so gave me his blessing, wearily nodding his head, but with a sparkle in his blue eyes. Few have ever had a cooler father figure than Kenneth Rexroth was to me. I sold most of my inventory and rented a 9th Street floor through in Greenwich Village, and met Ann Latterman right about then, where I'd host Burroughs and his crowd. The building was owned by Henry Geldzahler, then Cultural Commissioner of New York. Mind you, both front and back rooms and the hallway that connected them were double-shelved floor-to-ceiling with books, and I continued a little bit to dabble in rare books, although privately and far less actively. I stopped issuing catalogs and threw all my other energies and savings into Conjunctions and my writing. My original conception of Conjunctions was that it would be published biannually rather than as a quarterly, be more book than journal length, so it would be harder to toss aside. That it would champion writers whose work was formally innovative and thus not the fare that was found in mainstream outlets. I wanted to mix established with emerging writers, and I'd always found literary journals that advocated the one or the other to be, by definition, narrow in scope. I think my work in rare books and knowing older writers when I was young contributed to an innate sense of how generations of artists overlap and inform one another. Last, I assured myself, given all the logistical issues of running it, I would edit it for a few years, map out a concise period of contemporary avant-garde literature, and then be done. 30 years and 4 publishers later, having edited in the neighborhood of 25,000 pages by well over 1,000 writers and some 62 issues, I'm glad that my modest original goal didn't quite predict the journal's future. Next year will mark the 25th anniversary of Bard's publishing stewardship of Conjunctions. Without Bard, Conjunctions would probably have gone the way of most lit mags, and that would have been a fond memory. It's really Bard just, that's another essay for another time. After my marriage dissolved, to this day we're still close, by the way, I became involved with a master printer, the proprietor of Grenfell Press. Some of Conjunction's covers were letterpress printed on a Vandercook proof press, and Leslie Miller even taught me how to run the press well enough to help a little with the printing of Conjunction's 6 covers. While these other activities were transpiring, I'd begun work in earnest on my first novel, Come Sunday. As most novelists would agree, there is a combined freedom and, how to put it, chagrin associated with writing a first novel. One experiences freedom because, as a rule, nobody gives a damn whether you're working on your first novel or not. And one feels chagrin because, as a rule, nobody gives a damn whether you're working on your first novel or not. The readership you will or won't eventually connect with have usually never heard of you, have no expectations one way or the other, and by definition cannot worry about your literary travails. I never attended any writing workshops, and so, as ever, had to simultaneously invent myself as a novelist, even as I was inventing my characters and narrative. Needless to say, none of my prior experiences with books prepared me for the sheer solitude, the isolation required to write a novel, especially a novel of 600 plus manuscript pages, as Come Sunday turned out to be. It was a maddening, exuberant, painful, glorious, appalling, soul-opening, hideous, ecstatic, wholly rewarding labor. The book came out in 1988 with a dust jacket blurb by, among other writers, my by then old faithful friend Burroughs, who in a moment of mortifying largesse compared Come Sunday to Conrad's Heart of Darkness and Kafka. I don't know what he was drinking that day. Simon and Schuster picked up my second book, The Almanac Branch, and the next several novels, Trinity Fields, Giovanni's Gift, and Ariel's Crossing, were published by Viking, which meant that a much earlier part of my life in books would come full circle, in that the paperbacks of these titles, as well as Come Sunday, were issued by Penguin. Now my work had taken its place on my Italian English teacher Mino Del Piano's sacred shelves of orange-spined books, I marvel. I had found my way back home, as it were. What I had learned as a sometime bookseller proved to be invaluable as a book collector, which is how I'd characterize myself today. And though my obsession with buying books went into kind of remission during the 80s and 90s, a wintry drive out to a book fair in New Jersey changed all that. I bought a signed first British edition of William Gaddis's J.R., one of my favorite novels, and perhaps another book or two. But when I laid eyes on an absolutely perfect set of Lolita in the Boston book dealer Peter Stern's display case, a set he had acquired a few days before in Europe, and one he agreed that was the finest he'd ever seen, a repressed bibliomaniacal madness started percussing silently but insistently in my head. Again, I believe a person has to somehow be psychoneurally wired in a specific way to feel the compulsion to acquire a rare book, such as Lolita, the Lolita that went back home with me to New York that day. One can attempt to explain the impulse as having to do with investment, insisting that a truly rare book will always go up in value. This is a highly suspect idea, since taste and canon change that really amounts to self-deluded hokum. The consummate bibliophile, a man named Nicholas Basmains, has a phrase for it that I like, a gentle madness, though it's also a particular form of love for books and all they contain and represent. Moreover, there's an inherent drive to act, however briefly, as a transient custodian of history. In my case, literary history, but for other collectors, the whole wide spectrum of human endeavor that is recorded and preserved in books. I should add that besides my rare books, I have a large working library of books filled with my underlining, scrawl, marginal notes, dog ears, dog earring, and the occasional split hinge and coffee stain. When it comes to my books, I'm equally capable of not quite fetishism, but what one might call palimpsestism. Turning a novel into a notebook. Indeed, I have several libraries. One consists of my reading books, another of my prized firsts from Swift's Tale of a Tub and Stern's Sentimental Journey Through France and Italy, through the Barto 20th century literature, Faulkner, Nabokov, Joyce, Cather, and so forth. And yet another of a couple thousand first editions of books inscribed to me by my writer pals over the last several decades. They're all equally important to me, from my vintage paperback of Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian, my teaching copy filled with notes and held together with scotch tape, to my first edition of both Blood Meridian and the elusive volume that McCarthy used for source materials, My Confession by Samuel Chamberlain. Books beget books beget books. Looking back over all these years of involvement with books, which includes my work as a professor of literature here at Bard, I realize I am a complete completist because in some ineffable way, I've always been trying to fill out that broken set of Dickens, emotionally and psychologically, imaginatively and idealistically. It's my nature to try to make things whole, to complete the incomplete, to bring writers together, to bring texts together, to assemble and build. I bought an early set of Thomas Hardy's works in dust jackets at a bookshop in Denver a while ago. The set was missing the trumpet major, and I made it my task to find a floating copy that perfectly matched the edition and condition of the set. When I finally tracked down the volume in London, I experienced an inexpressible nerdy joy, the joy of completion, of wholeness. That set now sits on a shelf a few feet from my writing table in New York, talismanic and in a way, even numinous. As for Dickens, I think it's safe to say I've made up for my childhood deprivation. I now own a set of nonsuch Dickens, complete with all the accompanying ephemera and prospectuses, even the original invitation to the 1934 publication party at the Waldorf Astoria. And yes, I guess I have to admit that if I caught some kid in dirty jeans sitting on my living room sofa reading my copy of Bleak House, my response might not be altogether patient. On the other hand, after gently removing the volume from his clutches with a knowing frown, I would make sure to go to the other room to fetch a reading copy and let the poor fellow pick up where he left off with Esther Summerson, John Jarndyce, and the rest of Dickens' grand cast of characters. The book must, after all, live vividly, a radiant ball of light, in the mind as well as the hand.